The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we were continuing the discussion of sponges. I think I have said pretty much what I would like to you about them. I hope I have established in your minds that there simply is not any reasonable candidate for an organism that could have formed the sponges. There is nothing, no organism that would be a likely descendant from them. They simply exist. They exist in great variety. They are structurally different. All sorts of interesting abilities, functions. There is no sensible answer in my mind to the idea of an evolutionary basis to cause some kind of theoretical ancestor to form what we know today as sponges. And it is simply the necessity of the theory that requires even the idea itself. And again, we're talking about the fact that you can go and study sponges and find them fascinating and learn all the biology about them you need to without ever concerning yourself about whether they have evolved from something else and are in the process of evolving on to another organism of some kind. We will talk at some point about stasis, the idea that there are organisms using evolutionary timetables that have existed unchanged for hundreds of millions of years. This is a major problem to the evolutionists. Evolution is supposed to be universal. It's supposed to be, organisms are supposed to be changing all the time, and yet what we observe in nature is quite contrary to this. Now, the second phylum of animals that we're going to talk about a little bit is what are known as Cnidaria, C-N-I-D-A-R-I-A. The name that I learned from them, for them first when I was in college was Coelenterata. But for reasons I'm not altogether certain about, the new name is the one that is preferable now. This has to do, by the way, it is a name that is given because some absolutely unique cells, structures that are found in the organisms of this phylum, the cnidocytes. These are structures that contain structures that are known as nematocysts, organelles known as nematocysts that are have the capability of stinging. Some of you, if you have been out in the ocean and brushed up against a jellyfish, are have been beneficiaries of these structures' ability. And if you brush into enough of them, it has the capability of paralyzing an appendage, or in rare cases, the whole body, to the point where the person would die because of a lack of respiration or whatever. Some of these are very painful. Some of them are not. In some cases, the effect on the body depends on how many of the nematocysts have been discharged. In lab, we go through a procedure in which we add some material to a slide containing usually hydra that will cause the nematocyst to discharge so that they can be looked at. There are a variety of these nematocysts, different kinds. I'm not sure it is it's worthwhile for us to spend the time talking about all of them. Some of them sting, some of them are used to impale prey of one kind or another. The organisms, the lab organisms that we work with, of course, are hydra. If you have not had a zoology course, then it's likely that you have never seen live hydra. One of the things that always impresses the students when we begin this is that up to that point, their notion of these organisms is either a picture or they may have looked at slides of them. And both of those give one very confusing notion. They are simply frozen there in whatever shape they happen to be in the picture or on the slide. And the thing that impresses you immediately as you watch the live ones is the elasticity, the ability of these organisms to change size and shape. It is absolutely unbelievable how these bodies can stretch and change shape. And for the jellyfish, how they can ingest organisms 5 or 6, or in some cases 10 times as large as the jellyfish. And yet that is a possibility. One interesting, I don't know if it's an experiment, but something that can be done. If you have the requisite equipment, preferably a pair of very fine pointed forceps, and you can go down through the hypostome, the mouth of the jellyfish, and grasp the basal disc from the inside, you can pull the jellyfish inside out so that the external layer, the epidermis, is now on the inside, and what had been the internal layer, the gastrodermis, is now on the outside. And if you leave the thing alone after you've done that to it, come back several hours later, you would observe a very interesting change. During that period of time, all of the cells in these two layers would have reassumed their original position, so that the epidermis is back on the outside and the gastrodermis is back on the inside. These organisms do not have tissues. They have two germ layers. I have not defined that problem and don't intend to right here particularly. But the sponges, of course, they had only a layer, not even any tissue really. And the jellyfish have two different layers, the epidermis and the gastrodermis. The types of organisms that are found here vary unbelievably. You could see a hydra, a live hydra, in a dish, slide, whatever, if you knew what you were looking for. They're not very big, 1/8 of an inch maybe, 1/16 of an inch, depends. And they vary from that into jellyfish like the Portuguese man of war, where the body of the jellyfish may be as big as an old wash tub, 2-3 feet around, and the tentacles trail out from that central portion of the jellyfish for 20 feet or more. If you are a swimmer, you dead sure don't want to run into one of these. Now, we'll talk a little bit later about the relationship between nomius, a little fish that can swim around in these tentacles, either not discharging them or not having any effect on them, and actually act as bait for other organisms that will see the little fish swimming around inside these dangling tentacles and go after them and discover that the nematocysts that are there are very effective in paralyzing them. And the Portuguese man of war then will use these animals as food, and of course the nomius is rewarded because they would also then act as food for that. And we could have some discussion about how this relationship could have evolved. And I don't see any sensible basis on which that might have happened. To me, again, it speaks to the matter of a creator creating the organisms with that relationship. And we'll talk about, at some point, this kind of a relationship where neither organism can live without the other. That probably is not true in this case, but at least both the Portuguese man of war and the nomius get along better together than they would separately. Size difference, there are structural differences, there are class structural differences that we could spend some time talking about. Let's discuss for the moment here, simply to describe the classes of organisms that we find in the Cnidaria, the phylum Cnidaria. The most common one are the Hydrozoa. This includes the jellyfish. There are the Scyphozoa. These are forms of jellyfish, usually rather small, usually solitary polyps. We do have a alternation of generations, an alternation of a sexual and an asexual generation. Again, I have some problems about how that kind of a relationship could have evolved, but I'm not sure the radio program is a good time to go into a discussion. There'd be a lot of things we'd have to talk about. I'm not sure it's worth it. There also a recent addition here is a class known as the Cubozoa. These are usually fairly small, structurally very different from the rest of them, but having a bell and an umbrella and so on. The fourth class, very interesting, this is the Anthozoa. And these, of course, include the anemones. And if, again, you're around the ocean, you probably have run across these things. But they also include the coral organisms. So you have a variety of sizes and structures and capabilities that are here. And again, no reproductive potential between one organisms in one of these classes and another. And I won't labor the point further than is necessary, but one, there's not any organism that we're aware of that could have been the ancestor to these organisms, and there is certainly nothing that would be the descendant from them. And when you understand the variety of organisms, how evolution could have prevailed on some kind of mythical ancestor to have changed itself into what we recognize today as these forms is simply, again, beyond my ability to comprehend. There is not any scientific evidence that would shed light on the problem, and it is the idea exists purely and simply because people have decided to accept the general idea of evolution itself, and evolution then would require the kind of relationships that we're talking about, in spite of the fact that we have never observed these. We do not observe any kind of reproductive relationship between the classes. We do not know of organisms that could have formed them, and we do not know any kind of organism that would have been a descendant from them. So that because of the prior assumption of the idea of evolution, the evolutionists find themselves in a position where there really is no evidence that would support the necessity of the idea, and yet it is eminently sensible to believe that these things could have been created by an omniscient, omnipotent creator.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.